Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. HRN is food radio supported by you. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network since 2009. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hey, welcome to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host. This is Thursday, October 5th, 2023, and it's the night kicking off Cider Week in New York. We're here in the studio at Roberta's Pizza. We have two great people who love cider and indie folk music, so this is going to be our special cider and folk music show. So let's go around the room and introduce each other. I'm Jimmy Carboni again, the host of Beer Sessions Radio. Elizabeth, upstate, what's your name?
Elizabeth Ryan, fermenter, pomologist, and cider maker.
And one of the pioneers in New York State cider. And Fee?
Fee Doyle, short for Felicity. I'm a bartender, beer tender, cider drinker. Used to write a bit about beer in those before times. But yeah, glad to be here.
And now you work at Beer Witch.
And I work at Beer Witch in Park Slope.
So it's cool. So we've got someone who is not only growing apples and making cider, we've got someone else that selects and sells it. So this is one of those shows where why we want you coming into the city for Cider Week, because there's a lot of accounts and beer bars and restaurants that want to know more about cider. And to me, that's always what Cider Week's been about. So, Elizabeth, a little background on you. I mean, tell us about the farms that you run, and a kind of quick survey of the different apples and just an overview so everyone gets it. Because we see you at Green Market, but we never can quite figure out which farm is yours.
Well, for a really long time, we had one little farm, Breezy Hill Orchard. We founded Green Market. But we started growing, and people started offering us these incredible historic farms, Stone Ridge Orchard, Drumlin Farm, Adair Winery, and Knollcrest Farm. And we just couldn't bear, you know, we were growing the cider business, we were growing the farms, we were growing other stuff. I went to Cornell, and I started making hard cider in 1980, before any of you guys were born, 1980, when I was at Cornell. I started making cider legally in 1996. And most of the guys that were really the venerable old cider makers, I went all over New England and New York, and they were mostly, I hate to say it, dead. They were mostly dead. So I felt I had to go to the mothership across the ponds. I went to England and I studied in Hereford and Somerset. And that was the beginning of many, many trips to kind of apprentice and learn from Richard Sheppy and Julian Temperley and some of these legendary guys. And what I found there was the thing they make called Scrumpy was the thing that I fell the most in love with. And that was this rustic, unfiltered farm cider, unsulfided. And we had no analog in the market in America. I mean, we used to drink a lot of that stuff. But we stopped, whether it was prohibition, whether it was switching to grain-based beer, whatever. So I wanted to kind of rediscover the category. And that was the beginning of my journey. So
I like that you brought that up, because I was talking with Fee, and I remember that this start, from my journey in cider started with cider, the first Cider Week in 2011. And I remember it was like just discovering. It was like there's the classic styles in Spain and in England and France. And then it's like, who's making cider in you know, the Northeast? And is it still, is it sparkling? And I think it was 2016 when I was with Andy Brennan from Aaron Burr, and he said, listen, I've got something that we don't sell, but it's only for our CSA. It's called Scrumpy. And I thought I loved it. So what I'm seeing as things evolving now, it's kind of like the old school is what everybody wants. And I love the other day you said you're making a Scrumpy now. And remember, for like 10 years, everyone was talking about heritage apples and heirloom apples. And now we're back to Scrumpy. Let's talk about Scrumpy. This is a cool show. This is the Scrumpy show now.
And I've never actually heard of the term Scrumpy until today. So this is a great learning moment for me. Yeah.
Well, what is Scrumpy? Like, you know.
Okay. You had to ask, Jimmy. You just opened Pandora's box. So when I first went to England, you drive around and you see these little signs by the side of the road. They say Scrumpy. And everybody knows what it is. It's farm cider. You buy it, you know, they sell it in the barn, and it means that it's rough and it's raw and it's unprocessed and it's unfiltered. And the term Scrumpy has been around for a very long time. It's, you know, probably Elizabethan. And there's a term called scrumping for apples, and that means getting the windfalls or stealing apples. But there are many other, some of which I cannot say on the air, but
not safe for
we
work.
Launched with what we called Farmhouse Scrumpy in 96. And when we started going into Irish and English beer bars in New York, we learned really fast that there were a lot of other popular culture terms of art that Scrumpy meant. And maybe I'll leave it at that, but I'll leave it to your imagination. But, you know, there's always been a close association with cider and sex and orchards and apples. It goes back to the Bible.
Well, the Bible, Adam and Eve, of course.
Yeah. You know, so Scrumpy in England means a raw, fresh cider, but there are many other ways people use the word scrumpy.
Maybe you can elaborate, because this is an adult show. It's a 21 plus show.
Well, you know, it basically means, you know, to have sex. I mean, it's a kind of euphemism for fuck in some way. So,
all right.
Scrumping for apples. And, you know, any way you slice it, it's a fun, delicious thing, okay? Yeah. It is the best. And it is the least tampered with. And when I studied cider making, and I went and I took Peter Mitchell's great course in Hereford, and I was one of the first Americans to go over there, people were still being taught to sulfite the ciders, first of all, to kill all the wild natural yeast. And, you know, pretty standard winemaking of, you know, the 50s before the movement. And then you were taught to inoculate with a very carefully selected yeast, usually champagne yeast. That's a hard, fast ferment, champagne yeast, but it works really well with apples. And then people would filter ciders, and then they would sulfite them, and they'd stick them in a bottle, and they, you know, it was expected that they had to be able to ship, and they had to be around for a while. And sometimes people would carbonate them and force carbonate them. So that's the way I was taught to make cider. And like Andy, I always made Scrumpy and sold it, and we sold it in the farmers markets. And our distributors, honestly, I'm curious about your end of things. I mean, people fought me tooth and nail. They didn't get it. They didn't understand it. It was, quote unquote, unstable. What a horrible thing. It had bits and pieces and lees in the bottles. People found that horrifying in some places. And when Wassail opened, Dan Pucci, the great Dan Pucci, he got it right away, and we always had a draft line for our Scrumpy there. And they poured a lot of our scrumpy.
Good job, Dan. Hey, Fee, evolution of styles, you know, you've been serving craft beverages for a number of years.
Yeah.
How have you seen cider evolve? And
well, I think one of my favorite things in being like more a beer-centered service is cider. There is just a kind of a background developing taste for it, or maybe more of an underground thing that I think people who crave as much like variety as they would in their beer, like balance of acidity, tannins, and just like variants of mouthfeel, all these things we look for in like a pleasing beverage. Introducing people to cider is really one of the most exciting things because it's just, very undersung, and it's refreshing and very different ways. And especially, you know, we're all in New York State, and I know, Jimmy, you talk about revitalizing the Northeast agriculture in many ways, that it is like a traditional beverage for this area of the country. That's what I nerd out and get passionate about, like historically. As in terms of like being in the bar and serving it to someone who, like at Beer Witch, we have a dedicated cider line. Believe right now we have a New York Cider Company. They're up in Ithaca. I think it's this option that's presented that people just go, oh, yes. And it translates to wine drinkers the easiest because of the fermentation and the processes are a lot more similar than as opposed to beer making.
Sophia, just at Beer Witch, how many lines of beer do you have on tap? And then there's one line of cider?
We have 13 lines. We'll have one or two ciders at one time, but always at least one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's a good way to introduce people to it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, Elizabeth, what did you just pour? Because I know you've got a whole bunch of ciders in front
sounded,
of you.
Sounded nice.
Yeah. Did you hear? I was actually just tasting. So I've got four ciders in front of me.
Let's do one at a time, and then we'll tell you what we're drinking. But I want to keep talking about the scrumpy because I feel like scrumpy is now, and I feel like it's what's going to set cider apart. I feel like we had the growing stages, and then it was like, okay, let's talk about the historic apples. But at some point, that's exciting, but not really. And it's really what's in the glass, mm-hmm. right? And if I'm at, whether I'm at Beer Witch or some other place, if I got a glass of Scrumpy, I'm sure that Wassail with Dan Pucci, he got it right away. So what are you drinking?
Well, so I have four things. Do you want me to talk about just one?
Do one at a time, and then we'll talk about something else.
The first one I'm drinking, it's such a huge classic. It's almost, a lot of people make it, but it's Northern Spy. And Northern Spy is a New York State apple that originated in the 1830s. It's a classic. It's grown all over the country. But there's something about a spy, and it's got, to me, a very distinctive taste, and it's a little bit, it's always pretty, I know it sounds like such a truism to call it apple-y or green apple or fruit forward, but it's all of those things. And that's what I'm drinking. I'm looking at it. It's got this gorgeous color, and it's Pet Nat. There's a fine line between Pet Nat and Scrumpy. Maybe there's no line at all, but it's got this beautiful mouthfeel because it's got a very fine bubble to it. And that's always a little tricky for me as a cider maker. I've got to catch it and I've got to bottle it in exactly the right moment. And it's not very forgiving. And, when Andy first started, he had on the back of his labels, and I loved this, and it said, sometimes effervescent. And I just thought that was genius.
So how do you find that moment? I mean, and how long is it? Just tell us the steps. So you grind and press, right?
Well, so if I can just nerd out a little bit, you got to have good apples. And, you know, they've got to be picked. And there's a great temptation. And this is a wet year, to be honest. I'm struggling with the apples. Everyone is, because we've had so much rain. It's like wine. We have wet fruit. And I need to get the sugars up. I am like holding back from picking so many things. It's making the guys who work for me literally crazy. They want to pick. They want to pick this fruit. The color's amazing. And I'm like, taste these wine saps. They suck. They're not there yet. The sugar isn't there. They're like so wet from all this rain. So I think they're going to sugar up. Today's, it dried out. So I'm looking for, as a producer, I'm looking for sugar and acid and flavor. Like, I need that sweet spot. And you would think it just happens every year. And that is weather driven. That's terroir. That is soil, growing practices, and weather. So that's the first thing. Then you want to hold as much of the aromatics and the polyphenols and all these, like, apples have like 200-300 flavor compounds. It's insane. And so you're trying to hold as many of them. And the factors are, first of all, they have to be there in the first place. So that's that ripe aromatic. You all know, the difference between a green pear and a ripe pear. And so we want that ripe apple, ripe pear. In France, they like lay the fruit out on the ground and they sweat the apples to get the flavor up, to intensify aroma. Nobody hardly does that in America.
Yeah.
Every year I want to do it, but I just like don't quite have the moxie, the time. There's so much going down. There's so much fruit to be picked.
What would that, sorry to interject, what would that sweating the apples, what does that look like practically on the farm? Is it laying them out just in a controlled
in France,
sun?
Yeah, if you drive around, you literally see tarps down on the ground and you see these mountains of apples and they're drying out. They're desiccating a little bit. It's sort of a natural process and they're just big heaps of them. And they're letting them begin, and you'll see the skins get all kind of crinkly and gnarly. And it's lowering their yields. So they're intensifying the flavor.
Right.
They don't do it much in England. It takes patience, and it's so embedded in their practice. Even if you go to some of the factory ciders, you drive in, and there's all these big, piles of apples sitting around.
What is that process called? Because I know it's like, it's when you trace something like a Val cider.
We call it sweating. I call it sweating. I'm sure there's a delightful French term for it, but I don't remember. And you lose yield. So, you're going to press that fruit and instead of getting 3 gallons to a bushel, you're going to get like 2 gallons. You're going to call it the angel's share or whatever. You're going to sacrifice some volume. So it's more labor intensive, but you're literally also cutting your yields down. But you're getting better, getting flavor.
Yeah, you're pursuing flavor. Interesting.
Yeah. And, it's time honored over there. But the way they do everything is so different. And so here, we're always in a hurry. We are always trying. We pick the apples. A lot of times we don't have the patience. And a lot of these cultivars, these heirloom varieties, they're actually not picked until late October or even November. And so Macintosh, a lot of these culinary apples that people want to eat, the true cider apples are very, very different. And I just really want to thank you for making the commitment to these cider lines, by the way. Pierwich is kind of a famous place, and we only self-distribute now, so it's been harder for us to get our ciders into these markets, but it's so important, and I just thank you, and it's such a natural really the growth for a lot of years. We all thought that cider was kind of aligned with wine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of times it was sold in a wine bottle and you saw it on a shelf. And the growth in cider has come from craft beverage, period, from mm-hmm. craft beer, period. And this whole wave of this generation of younger people, so to speak, who just like, they'll drink. I don't want to say they'll drink anything. Maybe they'll drink anything. But they're incredibly experimental and embracing of craft. And it's fueled the cider thing.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it's interesting too. This is a go-to thing that cider and wine is connected, but specifically like natural wine and sour beers, there's all these really interesting intersections. And I know in terms of like Beer Witch having a dedicated cider line, like it's my boss, owner, Krista. It's one thing I say all the time when I like someone comes in for the first time, it's like this tasting room, Beer Witch, the bar, we like seek to represent like beer on the entire spectrum. And like cider is a part of, you know, it's a best friend, the old pal of beer in a lot of ways, and appreciating it on that level. And I agree, like people are open to it. There's a lot of other like interest and kind of openings in beverages right now. Like there's a mead revival that's been happening, partially because it is a gluten-free beverage as well. But I find it fascinating because it is such a sweet beverage in general. But people are absolutely open to it if they're already in a craft beer space. Yeah.
Are you pouring much mead there?
We have draft mead occasionally. We do some bottle pours of meads or like a cherry wine, a really lovely Danish cherry wine right now. And we'll sell canned and bottled meads right next to our ciders in our cider fridge. So
yeah, and you guys are really at the top of the chain in terms of just like quality, like especially imports. And you know, mm-hmm. what's on tap right now? We'll switch it to beer for a minute. Like a couple of favorites right now that are on tap at Beer Witch. Because I know by the time you hear this, it's over, but you can still celebrate. They're celebrating their third anniversary this month in October. So congrats to Beer Witch.
Yeah, just in a few days. Let's see. Right now we've got some OEC local. It's Kashmir. It's a great lager. We've got Hill Farmstead. Motueka double IPA. We've got the New York Cider Company hop cider. We've got Halfway Crooks, really tasty Dortmunder style lager on our one of the features our bar has, and we love to nerd her out on, are these the side pull lucre faucets. They're from the Czech Republic originally, and the Czech people, they've just been making lagers for so long. They, you know, changed it up. So you can get what's called a Mlieko pour. So it's this very different textural experience for your beers. And we've also got like foreign export stout on from Ridgeway Brewing in the UK. And like, that's the kind of thing where maybe people have never had the opportunity to have a foreign export stout, and these more like specific regional historical styles that you don't see too often, that it's a joy for me to just introduce to people.
There's nothing like going to the one thing I love about post-pandemic, nothing like going to a really good craft beer bar, chance to not only taste different styles, but in a certain setting, and it's curated, you know, mm-hmm. it's not just one producer or something else. Mm-hmm. Elizabeth, back to you. So your Northern Spy cider, now you have different farms. What label is that under?
All the ciders are Hudson Valley Farmhouse cider.
So that's your Hudson Valley Farmhouse cider brand.
Yeah.
So you had that. And one time I had the Spitzenberg?
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God.
This is off Aesopus Spitzenberg. Used to have that around.
Aesopus Spitzenberg. We call that Spitz. that is such an elegant cider. I took that out. I gave a keynote talk. Excuse me for wheezing a little.
We're just happy that you're on. Everyone should know. You're upstate and are you in Millvale? Is that the town in Hudson Valley?
Well, we're in Stattsburg and Stone Ridge.
Oh. And that's about 2 hours north of the city?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And actually, one of the farms is pretty close to the town of Aesopus, where the Aesopus Spitzenberg originated in the 1700s, became very important apple. Believe it or not, George Washington grew them. Thomas Jefferson grew them. I'm not trying to be part of the, you know, great white father thing, but it's just a verifiable fact. Mm-hmm. These guys both came to New York and bought Aesopus Spitzenberg on Long Island at the in Newtown, Flushing, Queens. And these guys bought George Washington. There's correspondence on it. Went with John Adams, who drank cider every day. And they went to Flushing, Queens, Newtown, to the Prince Nursery and bought trees together. Mm-hmm. It's like crazy. It's like some crazy movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
So these apples have been around for a long time, but very few people are growing them. I took the Spitz. I gave this big talk at CiderCon, and we poured some of these great old apples. We had a bunch of producers there. Dan Pucci helped put it together. And it turned out I was the only person. Lots of people make a Northern Spy, hundreds and hundreds. But I was the only person, it turned out, that I could find in that moment who did 100% Aesopus Spitzenberg. I was the only one. That shocked me. I thought many more people would have been, there's not very much of it growing. That's part of it. And the people that are working with it a lot of times are blending it because they don't have enough of the stock. That'll change over time. And the other one I'm looking at, the Golden Russet. Golden Russet, this is a New York State russet. They grew thousands of acres of these things, mostly for cider, in Westchester County.
Mm.
So when we talk about like this apple history we have, it's so big. And it's also so disappeared in so many ways. I mean, in my wildest, I can barely imagine anybody growing apples in Westchester.
What would it take to get more people to grow? I mean, not just in orchards, but in people's yards and all that.
Well, I think we're seeing it. And one of the things that happened that we hoped would happen was sort of our fantasy 20 years ago, is that the kids would come back to the farms. And alcohol would lure them back. And so I can think of 10 or 20 orchards practically within earshot, you know, within driving distance, where kids have come back to the farms and they're making hard cider. So Dressel's are making Huguenot cider, and Clark's are about to launch a cider, and Locust Grove, Chip Kent, is doing cider. He's been there for 9 generations, but now they're doing cider. And the Wilklos, who sell in New York, Bad Seed, you know, they're doing cider. And they're all these young people. It's mostly somebody under 40. And I could go on and on. And they've come back to the farm.
And you know, Indian Ladder
is another great example.
Who's 1911?
Well, 1911 are further upstate, and I actually don't know them well, but they're very, very big growers, and they were growing a lot, kind of, I will say, you know, for the processing, for applesauce and apple juice, and they've been, you know, they're knocking it out of the court. They brought in a really fine winemaker, cider maker, and that's the other thing. I mean, we're like, this is not just stuff that you ferment in the garage. People are really bringing in some talent. And there's an organization, we basically brought the guy who wrote the book in England, Peter Mitchell, over to the States. And there's the Cider Institute of North America. And they've been doing for about 5 years a lot of really big staff trainings, the American Cider Association. Mm-hmm. There's now a certification program. You guys should think about that.
I am on my way to getting that certification. The level
congrats.
One. Yeah, my boss, Krista, has that certification. But it's all part of the educational aspect.
On that note, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes to talk more about cider certification on Beer Sessions Radio. All right.
This episode is brought to you by Roberta's, home of Heritage Radio Network. Roberta's was founded in Bushwick in 2008 and has become one of the most iconic restaurants in the country. HRN made its home inside of Roberta's in 2009, and together they have become part of the DIY fabric of the neighborhood. Roberta's is open for lunch and dinner 7 days a week and serves much more than just the famous wood-fired pizzas. Their team dreams up new salads, pastas, and sandwiches on the regular. Roberta's Tiki Bar is alive and well in the back garden, serving up frozen drinks in the summer and hot toddies in the winter. Stop by the bakery and takeout spot next door for fresh breads, sticky buns, and pizzas to go. But Roberta's also extends beyond Bushwick, with multiple locations in New York City, Long Island, and Los Angeles. You can also find their frozen pies in grocery stores around the country. The spirit of Roberta's, like Heritage Radio Network, is everywhere. Here's to many more years of pizza-powered radio. Learn more about Roberta's at robertaspizza.com.
Hey, welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on Heritage Radio Network. Hey, support us, become a member, heritageradionetwork.org/donate. We've been on the air now, it's probably almost 15 years. We've been doing Beer Sessions Radio. This is our 14th season. So thanks for your support and check it out, heritageradionetwork.org. So we got Elizabeth Ryan from Upstate Farms and Hudson Valley Farmhouse Cider and Fee Doyle from Beer Witch. So Fee, tell us about the getting certified for the Cider Institute of North America. I know our friend Ron Sansone has been on the board of that, so I've heard about it, but I never quite knew what it did.
Yeah, it's through the American Cider Association. It's, you know, the equivalent of Cicerone in beer or sommelier with wine. But so far I'm studying for level one. It's called the CCP. An overview of history of regions where cider apples are grown. Overview of, you know, when you look at in many food and beverage, like the flavor wheel and where even one specific apple, if you made a single apple cider from it, where it would hit on the scales of acidity, bitterness, etc. It's a really in the same way when I have a little level one certified beer server certification for Cicerone, in the same way of like elevating beer, talking about cider, and as you know, as technically and as glowingly as it deserves to be spoken about. And I think it's, I think like I said earlier, it's like presenting cider as if it is as delicious and wonderful and we should be talking about it in the same way that we discuss beer and wine. I'm working on it. So I'm all, I'm not as advanced a pommelier or, that kind of advancement.
That's fun. Elizabeth, I just heard you pour something else. What are you pouring?
Well, first of all, I have to big shout out again to Fee for doing this. And this is something that 10 years ago, first of all, would have been unheard of when I started in the 90s. I had to get on a plane and go over there because we didn't have a vocabulary here. So bravo to you. And it just brings me such joy to hear that you're doing this.
Yeah.
Because I realize that we've come a long way and people do need that vocabulary. So I hate to say it, but I have four ciders, but I jumped the line here. I couldn't help it because, so we've been barrel aging cider forever. And again, what do you need? You need a really fine, good barrel from a really good barrel source. And we've been buying barrels, rye whiskey barrels and bourbon barrels from a company called Hill Rock. I don't know if you guys have bumped into them in Columbia County doing Solera style.
Some say it's the best whiskey in New York. So.
Yeah, incredible. And so bourbon barrels can only be used for bourbon once. And so we buy their used barrels. We try to get a wet barrel when we can that's just been dumped. And so normally we do a bourbon barrel aged cider. And we sell through it really fast because, first of all, it's really good, but also beer aged cider in a beer barrel. And I try really hard for the cider not to get overwhelmed. And I usually use Northern Spy, by the way. It just feels right. It's iconic. And so since COVID, you know, we kind of pulled back and we pulled out of wholesale. And we sell a lot in the farmers markets and at our farm stand. We're beginning to get back in wholesale. So we have these incredible barrel-aged ciders that we aged longer than we ever would have or could have or intended to. And so we have these ciders that have now been in wood for 2 or 3 years. And that's what I'm drinking. I wish you guys could drink it with me.
So what are you doing? Is it too much?
Oh, my God. I'm just like practically having an orgasm here. I'm sorry. But
is this called the Woody?
It's what? Like scrumping. That.
You're scrumping with the Woody?
No.
Did I just say that? Jeez.
Did you just say that?
Sure did.
But it's
a wood barrel, you know, barrel, wooden barrel.
It's all, no, it's all right there. It's all right there. Low-hanging fruit.
Yeah. So the difference that this cider, when we pulled this cider out of barrel and bottled it a couple of weeks ago, and I was just like, are you fucking kidding me? Like, that was like, I tasted it and I was like, I don't even believe how good it is. And so then you ask yourself as a producer, is like, okay, is it merely that it was in wood longer? Is it the inherent quality? Of course, it's all these things. Is it that we put really good cider in? Is it that we, by sheer accident, left it longer? Normally, we're under so much pressure, like to tie up something for 2 years. You know, and that might not sound like a very long time, but we don't typically age for 2 years. It's elevates.
You also have to keep an eye on it too, right? I mean, you do have to check.
Oh my God, yeah. You lose a lot of it. You lose at least 10 or 20% of the barrels.
I would never have the patience for that. I can't even do sourdough starter. I'm like short order cook.
No,
all the
but
way.
A lot of things happened during COVID that were game changers. Mm. And one of the things that happened for me during COVID is I didn't have as big of a staff. And so we were juggling a lot more things. And anyway, I'm one of the reasons.
So it's a mistake. You just left it. You had to leave.
Disappointed that I'm not down there with you guys. I have to get you bottles of this because really wanted to drink this.
We're going to have you down. We're going to do this again in the winter. You're going to be in the studio
and
me and you.
Yeah.
See, and Jimmy, you guys get the color is so gorgeous. I'm just kind of, but more than that, it lingers on the palate and there's a thing that happens. I'm not that much of an expert, but you know, the longer you leave things in wood, there really is a magic alchemy that happens where you get these caramel notes, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And you get the long fibers and it's not that raw and there's no substitution for time. Like, you can't cheat on that. It's just got to be in the wood.
You know, I've had some old school farm ciders where the same thing, where it was like a raw, you know, heirloom tannic cider, whatever it is, acid, and it was in a barrel for a year. And those are some of my favorite style of ciders. I don't get that too often, but I feel like that's an old school method.
Well, it's done a lot.
Is that what you're talking about or something different?
Yeah. And it's got to be decent wood, too. That's part of it. So you can't, you know, Hill Rock is very high-end, beautiful. They're you know, their bourbons sell for, you know, $100, $120 a bottle, and using the best wood they can source. And I think that's a factor.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it affects, I feel like this is what you're saying also, that the mouthfeel, really, I have a sense of the wood itself when you are drinking something that has spent that much time in a barrel. Yeah, really lovely.
So that's kind of fun. And I have to admit, I skipped over two other ciders because, you know, I'm sitting here staring at this bottle and I'm just like, I have to.
Well, that's fun. Hey, you know, and Fee brought something cool. Whether it's Scrumpy or Pet Nat, that's a neat... We started a very cool conversation. Is it Scrumpy or Pet Nat? What did you bring, Fee? Because we just drank the whole bottle while we were sitting here.
We're done with it. So I've got a bottle from Black Duck Cidery. They're representing the Finger Lakes region. They're up in
Ovid. We know them incredibly well. He does some amazing things.
Yeah, and super wonderful. John, he will hand deliver our orders and talking about like person to person development of business from cider to beer. So we're drinking, this is called a Creamsicle Pear Cider.
So, oh my God, I've had that. That is so good.
It's so delicious. Yeah, it's a fruited cider, not a peary. And then it's just fun. It's from their cassette deck series. So this fits in with our love of music as well. Just cool picture of a little tape here. But so it's a blend of Seckle pears and then a crimson crisp apples, as well as some crimson, where'd they go? One sec. Crimson topaz. I think it's on the same lines. It's a wild fermentation, so no yeast pitched or inoculated. It's unfiltered, and you get that lovely like mouthfeel of an unfiltered cider.
But it has that raw quality.
The very raw quality.
So could this be called a Scrumpy?
Those three cultivars, that's a killer combination.
Mm-hmm.
Those are great varieties. And so right out the gate, you know, John's a real purist.
Mm.
And I'm becoming kind of a purist. But when you do those wild ferments, you always take a chance.
Mm.
It's not predictable. Like a champagne yeast, you know exactly what it's going to taste like. You know what's going to happen. So it's the people that are willing to do this. It's all small batch. It's bold. It's, and I think these small batch producers, and we have a lot of big, wonderful producers too, but, you know, these small batch producers are really kind of sticking their necks out, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, Elizabeth and Fee, that's why I got jazzed about Cider Week way back in 2011, because it was meeting all the small producers from the Northeast, including New York and now New England. And they're not taking chances as much as it's small batch. And it's what I love, whether it's indie music, in indie craft producers. I still love that. And I feel like these indie cider makers are still where it's at. And I'm just really happy that we're talking about this. And Scrumpy, let's wrap up and talk about Scrumpy first. So Scrumpy, again, it doesn't sound like much. I know there's an innuendos, but this right now we're drinking something that's raw. It's like a Pet Nat. I think in this case, the wine reference is important because everyone seems to say Pet Nat and they're willing to try it. How do you feel, Fee, as a person who's selling and serving people, to use that term when you're describing something like this? Does anybody ask for Pet Nat at Beer Witch?
Yes. I mean, we've frequently, I think based on our design aesthetics, we look like a wine bar from ostensibly outside, but our license is such that we don't serve wine and
you're a beer eating place, beer only.
Yeah, I'm wow. Like we can serve wines by the glass, but but we don't sell any to
restaurant
go.
Wine.
Yeah. It's a tavern license. I think it's, I will engage in those terms only when it kind of seems like it's going to benefit the interaction. I personally go to describing like mouthfeel, flavor, you know, how the color of the cider in the glass is, and any kind of general, just the, when you meet the person, you're like, what do they want me to say to them? So I can sell this beverage to them. I think Pet Nat and orange wine, as I said, mentioned earlier, but it's interesting to be like aware of these terms. They're not always necessary, but they're tools, I find.
Very good.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth, you wrap that one up. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So, you know, really, I'm not sure there's a line between Scrumpy and Pet Nat, no matter what. And I think it's, I'm interested, Fee, that you say that you're not, you know, I still struggle with this, even though I've been doing it for decades, how to communicate to the consumer the right thing. Of course, you want them to figure it out themselves, but I find that those words are important. I am gravitating a lot towards Pet Nat these days. We rarely say Scrumpy. And part of that is it's just people are like, oh, Pet Nat. Mm-hmm. And they know what it is. Mm-hmm. Scrumpy, they're like, oh, what? So
it's like you define something. One thing about beer is that, you know, there's often a brand or a style, and you can reference that. And I guess if you're referencing Pet Nat, then you kind of know what that is. So I get
what
it.
What people do now, they didn't 3 years ago. And I think it's always the craft small batch producers that are like the tip of the spear. Mm. We're always kind of like leading this. That's how I feel. And we're introducing it in accordance with folks like you, Fee, and you, Jimmy. I mean, you guys, but framing this language, and there's been such a long way to come because we had this break in our culture here, right? During prohibition, whatever you think of it. Mm. I've been finding out a lot more about my own family's adventures in prohibition, which were many, and they loved cocktails and they loved going into New York. And so I feel like we're just bringing it home with cider and beer too. I mean, I feel like it's just like a reset button for America. And that's very, very exciting. And Jimmy, you know, when we did the first cider week, you know, we had like 9 producers there, remember?
Oh yeah.
Now we could have 200.
It's amazing. How about we'll wrap it up? You guys each ask each other a question. We're both thoughtful people.
Mm.
But.
Mm.
Well, I have one, but it's sort of a low down question, but I am curious what you look for, Fee, in a cider. Personally, I forget your, you know, but what floats your boat as a beer drinker? Are you looking for tannin or bitters, or like what is it that makes you go, oh yeah?
Huh. Well, I feel like something that's mysterious to me about cider is when I have like something like what I'm drinking, a Scrumpy or a Pet Nat, is that it tastes remarkably close to what the experience of the fruit having, eating the actual apple is like. And I'm not thinking about it as if it's an alcoholic beverage. It erases something in that part of my brain. And those are the ciders that I'm like, oh, I just appreciate so deeply. And I suppose I lean toward medium carbonation and these kinds of like little details, but I appreciate a good amount of acid, and then tannins as well, just to give your like a different texture and mouthfeel. But I think it's the this is the juice of an apple. This is very lizard brain. This is the juice of an apple. It's alcoholic, but this is an apple, not like a grocery store apple. So, and like it, you know, it transports me a little bit. Yeah.
I hope you share that answer in one of those classes.
Oh.
They'll give you like an A+.
Okay.
Well, it's recorded for posterity. Yeah.
And I think that's very intriguing to me. So the fruit really speaks to you in addition to everything else. And I think that is the thing that is elusive when people scale up on ciders and they start doing these tight filtrations that they have to do. The first time I filtered my cider, I still remember it in 97. And we were making Maeve, our first, you know, release. And we ran it through the filter. And what the filter took out, flavor-wise, I literally cried. And I drank what was filtered out. And I made the guy who worked for me, I said, drink this. You're drinking the soul of the apple. And we just took it out. So... you know, when you're doing these, I think you're drinking a lot of these ciders that are probably unfiltered. Mm. And that's why they're keeping a lot of that aroma and essence and, you know, for a lot, you know, fruitiness.
And the power to you, Elizabeth, that you've stuck with it for so long. Fee, do you have a question for her? I know you
do.
Yeah.
For Elizabeth, I think it, like, it's inspiring to me as being someone who's younger, of a different generation in this beverage space. Like, I'm someone who you described earlier, so might come to make cider on a farm or a mill. And for you who you've been working so long in the cider space, is there something like being a woman in the beverage space? Like, this could be a whole episode unto itself, but that journey like for you, how has that journey been a little bit? And what do you think, is there something 20 years ago that you didn't know that you might know now? And I don't know if it's specific to cider, but I don't know.
Wow, there's 10 questions in that.
Yes.
But, really good questions. Really quickly on the women thing, I think historically women have always, you know, done a lot of fermentation and distillation. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, there's more and more scholarship on it. You know, John Adams didn't make cider. His wife made it for him.
Yeah.
And that's pretty well documented. But I will say at the time that I was sort of coming into this, and there were very, very few role models or mentors, I felt very embraced.
Mm.
And there were a lot of older men. The first guy that hired me, and he had lived and worked in France, and when he hired me, and I was having so much trouble. I was just telling this story today in 1980, and like nobody would even interview me or hire me. I wanted to work in the industry in wine then, not so much cider. And, you know, Mark Miller from Ben Marl Winery, one of the first farm wineries in New York State. And the day he brought me in and he hired me as vineyard manager for 75 acres of grapes. And I bought an orchard. But he said to me, you know, I really think it's time for the girls to have a chance, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
And that was a beautiful moment, right? Mm-hmm. And so... I feel like a lot of doors were beginning to open and I was able to walk through them. So that was a special time. I don't think it was like that 50 years ago or 100 years ago.
That's an amazing answer. So Mark Miller, yeah. He was like the first new like New York State licensed winery, wasn't he?
He literally wrote the bill. He wrote, there's this famous picture of him making the governor, and he had lived in France. I mean, I think part of the story here is those of us that kind of went to the old world, to Europe, to learn what we could there. Mark had lived in Burgundy and Bordeaux, And he was like came back here and he was like, what's wrong with us? He bought an old vineyard in the Hudson Valley. And we're trying to revive these old orchards. We're trying to save them. And it is a little daunting because real estate is worth so much money. So we're experiencing, it's like Sonoma now in the Hudson Valley. And a lot of these properties, obviously, they're worth more with houses on them. But anyway, I don't think I even answered your question.
But I think you did more than you think. Yeah. And I'm going to say, you guys are so awesome. And you know what? We're going to do this again. We're going to come back in the winter when we're all a little quieter and slower.
Fee,
and we're
I'm going to come and visit you, Fee. And we're going to pass the torch to you.
Yes,
and
please.
I think you should come up to my farm. And I'm going to be down at Cider Feast this weekend.
Okay.
But anytime you want to come and, you know, ferment some fruit or have a hands-on, you know.
Yeah.
Jimmy, of course, our door is always open.
You know, we are also so overdue. But whatever it is, we're going to do this again and keep talking deeper. I want to thank you both, Elizabeth Ryan and Fee Doyle. Thanks so much for joining me here on Heritage Radio Network. Big shout out to our engineer, Armin Spengen. I'm Jimmy Carboni. I'm the host on Beer Sessions Radio. Wow, going on 15 years here on Beer Sessions Radio. We'll catch you next time. All right. Woo. Hey, it's Cider Week somewhere in America. It's Cider Week this week in New York. All right, guys. See ya. Bye.
Beer Sessions Radio is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.